Chapter 10. The Discharge. Morning came in Mobile on the 13th of April, 1865, and I woke where the army had put me, in a city that had been Confederate 2 days before and was now under Federal guard. The floor had not grown softer in the night. My coat had not become a pillow fit for a home. Yet sleep had come, because sleep comes to a soldier when he has spent all his strength, and the body takes what mercy it can find. We had entered the city on the 12th. The works at Spanish Fort had fallen. Fort Blakely had been carried. Mobile, which had so long stood before the army as a name and an object, had become streets, houses, warehouses, churches, riverfront, guard posts, orders, and men set at corners to keep watch. A city is never so much a city to a soldier as when he is first ordered to occupy it. He does not see it as a traveler sees it. He sees what must be guarded, what may hide danger, what road leads where, what building has been assigned, where water may be found, where the company is to stack arms, where a man may lie down. We were still soldiers. That was the plain fact of the morning. The taking of Mobile had not ended our duties. It had changed them. We had gone from march and siege to occupation, but the army does not cease to be an army because the firing slackens. The musket still had to be kept. The roll still had to be called. Guards still had to be posted. Men who had been running under fire at Blakely now stood in doorways or at street crossings, watching a population that watched us in return. I thought that morning of the road by which we had come. A man does not choose the moments when memory visits him. He may be washing his face from a tin cup or buckling a belt, and suddenly see Wisconsin as plainly as if the Alabama air had opened and shown it to him. I saw Janet's house in my mind. I saw the children. I saw Moundville, not as a soldier on a map, but as a husband and father sees the place where his life is kept while he is absent from it. The war had carried me far from that place. Since I enlisted at Portage in February of the year before, I had learned the strange geography of service. New Orleans, the Red River, Alexandria, the work at Bailey's Dam, Baton Rouge, Morganza, Bayou Sara, Helena, Fort Gaines, the sand road from Navy Cove, the trenches before Spanish Fort, the charge at Blakely, Mobile. These names were not names only. They were hunger, heat, mud, sickness, tired feet, bad water, letters waited for, comrades buried, prayers made in the dark, and orders obeyed because there was no other way for a soldier to do his duty. We did not yet know, on that morning, that Lee had surrendered at Appomattox on the 9th of April, the same day we carried Fort Blakely. News traveled fast in some places and slowly in others. It traveled by wire where the wire remained, by steamboat, by dispatch, by rumor, by the mouth of one man speaking to another. An army in a city hears news before it knows whether the news is true. A man learns to wait. He has heard too many reports in camp, too many victories before they were victories, too many defeats enlarged by fear, too many orders contradicted before noon. Still, the word came. Lee had surrendered. The Army of Northern Virginia had laid down its arms. General Grant, whose name still carried weight among men who had served in the old 13th Corps and remembered Vicksburg, had received the surrender. The great army in Virginia, the army we had read about and measured our own fortunes against, had come to its end. There was gladness in that news. But it was not the gladness of men who had never seen war. It was a sober gladness because the dead did not rise to hear it. The men who had fallen at Blakely did not come back because Lee had surrendered 3 days before. The men who had died of disease in Louisiana and Arkansas did not answer the roll. The prisoners who had been taken, the wounded lying under care, the families waiting in Wisconsin and Iowa and Illinois and Maine and Indiana, all remained as they had been. Yet the news was great. It told us that the war had been struck at the heart. I remember men speaking of it with the tired wonder of soldiers who have waited so long for a thing that when it comes, they hardly know how to receive it. Some smiled and said home would come now. Some stood quiet. Some began to reckon terms of service, companies, muster rolls, the chances of being sent north. A soldier may love his country and still think first of the road home when the war begins to close. There is no shame in that. A man who has done his duty may long to stop doing it. Mobile itself received the news in another fashion. There were white citizens who kept their faces still or turned away from us, or watched as if the city had not yet decided what the new order would mean. There were black men and women whose faces told another history. I had seen that look when we entered. It was not simple joy, for no people who had lived under bondage could carry simple feelings at such an hour. It was hope mixed with caution, fear mixed with the first breath of something larger than fear. I was a soldier, not a statesman. I did not know what the country would make of freedom once the armies were done. I knew only that the United States flag stood where it had not stood, and that the people who had been held as property watched that flag with eyes that made a man consider the weight of it. Then, before the first news had settled fully in us, another news came and struck the camp colder. The president had been killed. Abraham Lincoln, who had borne the war through 4 years, had been shot in Washington on the 14th of April and had died the next morning. The report reached us in Mobile days after the deed. I cannot now set down the exact hour when the word came to me, for the record does not preserve it. I know the fact. I know the shock of it. I know that the surrender and the death came upon us so close together that a man could scarcely separate them in his heart. What the record does not say. The word passed first as rumor, and rumor in an army has a sound of its own. It moves faster than orders and is believed less, yet every man turns toward it. I was near other men when I heard it. Someone had come from headquarters or from a post where the dispatch had been read, and the words were spoken in that low, hard way men use when the thing said is too large for shouting. The president is dead. For a moment I did not take the meaning. Dead might mean sick unto death. Dead might mean some report twisted by travel. Dead might be another camp story made monstrous by distance. Then the rest came. Shot. Ford's Theater. Washington. Died the next morning. I remember the street, the heat, the look of the men near me. One man's mouth opened and no words came. Another swore under his breath. Another took off his cap. I thought of the president not as a man I knew, for I did not know him, but as the man whose name had stood above all our orders, all our marches, all the paper money in a soldier's hand, all the proclamations read in camp, all the speeches printed in papers that came south by mail. I had prayed for the war to end. I had prayed to be brought home. I had not prayed to see the end come by such a road. What I felt first was not speech. It was a heaviness in the chest, as if the whole army had been ordered to halt and bear a weight no quartermaster had issued. The city around us remained the city. The sun remained the sun. Men went on standing where they had been posted. Yet something in the victory had been darkened. Lee had surrendered, and the president had been murdered before the country could rightly breathe. I thought then of Janet, and of how the news would travel north to her, and of how every household would sit with it. I had seen men die in uniform. This was another kind of death, and it reached every camp and every home at once. After that, occupation duty took on a different temper. The war was ending, but it had not ended in peace of feeling. Confederate officers were being paroled. Men who had fought us were laying down arms under terms. Citizens who had supported the rebellion now moved under federal authority. The army had to stand between what had been and what was coming, though none of us could see clearly what that future would be. Soldiers are often set to work before any man can explain the full meaning of the work. In early May, General Richard Taylor surrendered the Confederate forces in Alabama, Mississippi, and East Louisiana. That surrender belonged directly to the world around us. It told us that the fighting in our region was done in any large sense. Later in the month came the surrender of Kirby Smith beyond the Mississippi, the last great Confederate force in the Trans-Mississippi. The war that had seemed to have no end was ending by papers, by paroles, by commands sent down lines, by armies dissolving where they had once gathered. It is a strange thing to see an army begin to come apart. A campaign gathers men into one purpose. A march makes them one body. A battle drives them into one line. But the end of war separates them again. Companies count their terms. Regiments look for orders. Men ask who will go first. Veterans who have served their time begin to pack in earnest. Officers who once spoke of roads and works now speak of muster rolls, transportation, returns, and discharge. We remained in duty. We guarded. We watched property. We saw prisoners and paroled men. We heard of stores being accounted for, of Confederate material gathered and held, of departments changing as the armies no longer needed to move as they had moved. The Department of the Gulf, like the rest of the military world, had to learn how to become smaller. It had been made for war. Now it had to govern the space after war. On the 14th of May, while I was still in the South, Janet wrote from home. Her letter belonged to the chapter of the war that the Army did not write. She did not know all that I knew by then. She did not know, when she wrote, exactly where I was or what dangers had passed over me. A wife at home lived behind the news. She might receive a paper with reports of a battle, but the paper did not tell her whether her husband had stood in the line, whether he had been wounded, whether he had been buried, whether he was sick, whether he had written and the letter had not yet reached her. By that date, she had my letter of April 25th from the year before in memory, and other letters that had come in their seasons, but the war had taught her that any letter might be the last for a time. She had children to care for, a farm and household to manage, neighbors to hear from, weather to watch, money to reckon, and still she had to wait for the post. Waiting was a labor of its own.
From Janet's hand, May 14th, 1865. I have a lively hope of seeing you soon. Now I earnestly pray that God will protect you from all danger when you are coming home. That is all my safety at present. There has been so many soldiers lost lately on their way home.
Those words were written from the other end of my service. I was in the machinery of the army, waiting for orders and discharge. But she was in the house where my absence had been counted in chores, letters, fear, and hope. Her prayer named a danger I had not considered as deeply as she did. The war might be ending, yet men could still be lost on the way home. Rivers could burn. Boats could fail. Sickness could overtake a man after the last battle. A wife had the right to fear the road home as much as the battlefield, because until a man crossed his own threshold, he was not home. Through May and June, the army thinned. Men who had been hard used by weather, battle, and disease began to speak more openly of Wisconsin. There is a difference between longing for home in the midst of a campaign and expecting home after the firing is done. During a campaign, longing must be folded small and put away, because the next order may require every part of a man's attention. After surrender, longing grows large. It sits beside him at breakfast. It walks beside him on guard. It wakes with him when the bugle sounds. It begins to measure every delay as a personal trial. The main body of the 23rd Wisconsin mustered out on the 4th of July, 1865. That date had already belonged to the regiment's history because Vicksburg had surrendered on a 4th of July 2 years before. Now another 4th came, and for many of the men it meant the formal end of service. They had been mustered into the nation's need, and now the nation released them. I was not released with them. That is a plain sentence, but a man may live many feelings inside it. The regiment to which I belonged, Company C, the Portage Rifles, the men with whom I had marched and camped and fought, began to pass out of the army's hand while I remained. Some men had terms that held them longer. Some were detained by the conditions of enlistment, by transfers, by garrison needs, by the imperfect machinery of an army too large to dismiss all at once. The exact manner by which I was held after the main muster is not preserved here with the clearness I would wish. The record knows that the regiment's main body mustered out July 4th. The record knows that my discharge came January 6th, 1866. Between those dates lies half a year of waiting inside a war that was over and an army that still required service. I will not invent orders I cannot prove. I will not name a unit or post with a certainty the record does not give. I can say what such a time meant to a soldier. It meant living under command while the purpose of command had changed. It meant seeing other men go north. It meant hearing more often from home, and yet being no nearer to home. It meant watching the South after defeat, where soldiers who had once moved against an enemy now stood among civilians, freed people, paroled men, and the remains of Confederate administration. It meant days that were quieter than battle, and sometimes heavier because quiet gives a man room to feel delay. Summer in the Gulf Country had already taught us its ways. Heat lay upon the camps. Sickness remained a danger even after bullets had ceased to fly. The regiment had lost far more men to disease than to combat across its service, and no man who had served in Louisiana or Alabama could forget that fact. War in that country was not only rifle fire. It was fever, foul water, bad air, long marches in wet places, and the slow reduction of men who had left home strong. By August and September, the great movements were past. The names that had filled dispatches were becoming part of memory. Red River was behind us. Mobile was behind us as a campaign, though we might still be in its reach as soldiers. The end of the Confederacy did not make the roads shorter, nor did it make the army's papers move faster. A man remained where he was told until his name was called for discharge. I thought often in that long autumn of my first days as a soldier. I had enlisted at Portage in February of 1864, at 32 years of age. Not as a boy seeking adventure, but as a husband and father entering a hard duty. At Camp Randall, I had still been more farmer than soldier. I knew work, I knew weather. I knew the obligations of a household and the obligations of faith. The army had taught me its own lessons. It had taught me how quickly a man may become one part of a larger body. It had taught me how far a letter must travel to keep a family whole. It had taught me that courage is often less a feeling than the act of staying in line. The mail, when it came, was a mercy. A letter from Janet carried the house inside it. It carried the children, their schooling, their sickness, their improvements, their small troubles, their questions, their words when words could be spared. It carried weather, crops, neighbors, debts, hopes, and prayers. I had once written home from New Orleans that I was thankful for health. By the end of the war, I knew more fully what that meant. Health was not only the absence of sickness, it was the preservation of the body through all the ways the war had tried to spend it. Men talked of home in practical ways because practical talk can hold feeling without exposing it too plainly. They spoke of trains, boats, routes, pay, clothing, farms, wives, children, work, waiting, tools, debts, land, schools, churches. One man wondered whether his children would know him. Another wondered whether the farm had gone behind in his absence. Another feared he would not know how to live without the company around him, though he would not have said so in those words. The army makes men long for home, and then sends them home changed by the longing. There were also silences no man knew how to fill. What does a soldier say after the battles are over about the men who will not go home? on a march or before a fight, there is no time to settle that question. Afterward, it comes and sits with him. Peter LaFleur, whom we knew well, had not come through the Red River year. Others had fallen or died in hospital or been worn away by disease. The role of the living could not be called without the absent answering in memory. Autumn passed into winter. The South did not become Wisconsin because the calendar turned. I measured the season less by snow than by letters, and by the old northern habit of expecting cold. Somewhere far away, Janet would be managing the house against winter as she had done before. There would be wood to consider, clothing, school, the children's health, the ordinary provisions by which a family crosses the cold months. I was still absent. The thought tried my patience more than any one duty did. At last the date came, January 6, 1866, my discharge. There is a formality to leaving the army, and formality matters. A man does not simply walk away because the war is over in his own mind. He is a soldier until the papers and the officers say he is not. His name must be accounted for. His service must be entered. His arms and equipment must be settled according to rule. Pay must be reckoned. The nation that had taken him into service releases him by writing, as it had held him by writing. When the discharge came, I was no longer only waiting. The road home had become real. I had thought of it so many times that the first certainty of it almost seemed less solid than the longing had been. A man may dream of a thing for months and then stand puzzled when the door opens. The journey north was another passage by water and rail, as so much of my soldiering had been. The obituary written many years later would count the miles of my service, miles by railroad, miles by steamboat, miles by marching. I did not count them in that fashion then. I counted by distance from home, south to north, river to rail, camp to landing, landing to town, town to another line of travel. The Mississippi had carried armies and supplies and wounded men and prisoners. Now it carried discharged soldiers toward the places from which they had come. A steamboat on the river after the war was not the same as a steamboat moving troops toward danger. The water looked no different, but the meaning of the deck had changed. Men stood with bundles and papers instead of loading for a campaign. They watched the banks not as soldiers entering another department, but as men leaving one. The river towns came and passed. Smoke lay behind the boat. The engine worked. The current had its own will. Every mile north was a mercy. I thought of Janet's fear that soldiers might be lost on their way home. That fear was not foolish. We had all heard of disaster on the rivers. Men who had survived prisons, marches, and battles could be taken by boiler, fire, collision, storm, or sickness before they reached the arms waiting for them. I did not consider myself safe because I had a discharge in my pocket. I considered myself nearer. Safety would be the threshold at Moundville. As the country changed, my mind changed with it. The flat warmth and wet ground of the Gulf Country gave way by degrees to the places that spoke more nearly to my memory. The names became northern names again. The air sharpened. Men who had been strangers in the South began to look like men returning to their own weather. I had left Wisconsin a soldier. I was returning with the same body and not the same life inside it. What does a man bring home from war? He brings what can be seen. Papers, clothing, perhaps a small possession saved through marches, the pay due him, the marks of sun and sickness, the look of a man who has lived too long under orders. He also brings what cannot be seen, the sound of firing that comes back in quiet, the memory of men falling, the smell of wet earth in trenches, the knowledge of how quickly a letter may become precious, the habit of waking ready, the restraint that keeps him from telling too much at once. I did not wish to burden Janet with all of it the first hour. She had borne her own war. It had not been fought with musket and cartridge box, but it had been fought with waiting, work, fear, children, farm, prayer, and the carrying of a household while the man who belonged there was gone. A husband returning from service must remember that home has not been standing still for him like a picture. Home has been laboring, too. When I came at last to Moundville, the war ended for me in the only way a war can end for a man with a family. Not by proclamation, not by surrender paper, not by a general's order. It ended by sight. The house, the land, the shape of the place, the door by which I had gone out and by which I now returned. Janet, the children. Lizzie was older than the child I had carried in my mind. James and Sarah Ann and Eddie had lived months of growth while I was absent. Children do not pause because a father is away. That is one of the griefs and mercies of it. They grow, and by growing they prove that life has continued. I had been preserved to see it. I cannot set down every word spoken at that meeting. Some things are not made truer by being forced into speech after the record has gone silent. I know the fact of return. I know the house received me. I know Janet's prayer had been answered to that extent that I had been protected from danger on the way home. I know that the man who crossed that threshold was a discharged soldier and a husband again under his own roof. That first night in my own bed was unlike any sleep I had known in the army. A bed is not only softness, it is permission. It tells the body that no sergeant will call it up for guard. No drum will beat assembly before daylight. No order will send it down a road it has never seen. No musket need be kept within reach. I lay there with the knowledge that the ceiling above me was mine to wake under. Sleep did not come all at once. Habit does not leave a man because papers say he is discharged. I listened in the dark. A house has sounds as a camp has sounds, but the meanings are different. Boards settle. A child stirs. Wind moves against the wall. A wife breathes beside a husband. These are not the sounds of danger. They are the sounds of belonging. In the morning, I woke in Moundville. That was the end of the chapter of my soldiering. The work of life remained, as it always remains. There would be farm matters to learn again, accounts to settle, children to guide, church to attend, neighbors to meet, strength to recover, and a country to mend in ways far beyond my own house. But I was no longer waking in a camp. I was no longer waiting for a discharge. I was home. The first common tasks after return had a strangeness in them. To take up an ordinary tool, to step outside without permission, to stand in one's own yard and look at weather as a farmer looks at it, not as a soldier measuring a road or a camp, required a quiet adjustment. I had thought often of home as rest. It was rest, but it was also responsibility restored. The place had continued without me, and now I had to fit myself back into it without pretending that my absence had not cost Janet labor and loneliness. A returned soldier may be welcomed and still need humility. The household he enters has been kept by others. So the war closed for me not in one clap of sound, but in the slow return of ordinary things. A pail, a fence, a child's lesson, a place at table, a Sabbath morning not counted against a march. The right to sleep and rise where God had planted my family. These were not small matters. They were the very things for which a man endures the large matters.
Looking back from the diary I bound at 70, a man thinks while he is in the army that coming home will be a single moment. He thinks of the door, the wife, the children, the hand clasp, the first meal, the first night in his own bed. Those things are true, and I thank God for them. But coming home is larger than the arrival. I had to learn the quiet again. I had to learn that a field did not need to be crossed in line, that a road did not hide an order at the end of it, that a letter on the table was not the only thread by which home was held to me. I had to learn my children not as names written in a soldier's letter, but as living souls changing day by day before my eyes. When I enlisted, I knew duty. When I came home, I knew more of its cost. I knew that the Union had not been preserved by speeches only, nor by generals only, but by the bodies of men who marched, dug, waited, sickened, fought, and died, and by the households that bore their absence. I knew also that a man may be spared and still carry the spared life as an obligation. So I came home in January of 1866, not finished with labor, not finished with sorrow, not finished with memory, but finished with soldiering. The Lord had brought me through. Janet had kept the house. The children were before me. The war was behind me. I slept under my own roof, and in the morning I rose not to the bugle, but to the life that had been waiting.